Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me, Mike Cosentino.
Right here in the flesh.
Beloved co-host.
That's right.
And today we're focusing on a new book by Silent Gary LeMaster, who's not going to be silent today because we're going to be asking him a bunch of questions. His new book is out. It's out as a Kindle edition on Amazon, and it's available in paperback. It's about $20 in paperback. It's huge. It has 500, and we joke about Gary's research on the show, but it has,
Thorough it is.
Yeah, how
thorough research.
But this is a big book,
Well, book is no less thoroughly researched.
It's 567 pages or something?
There's like 45 pages of references. I pretty thoroughly researched it. And the thing is, I cut it down by about 100 pages. I kept taking out things. I had a complete conservative dictionary in the back.
Oh. Well, when you choose Republican lies as your subject, you're lucky to squeeze it in.
Let's read the title of it. Antidote for Fact-Free Politics.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah. So start again.
Antidote to Fact-Free Politics, debunking the falsehood, fabrication, and distortions told by conservatives and perpetrated by the media. And it has a wonderful cover, which I don't think I'll describe on the air, of a teapot elephant expending some gaseous energy.
Yeah. some lies, but from the other end.
Some methane.
Wrong in commentary. And a teapot elephant.
That's my friend Brooke, who designed the cover for me.
It's a really nice cover.
It's a great logo.
Even though it's a long book, it is a very easy read.
What was the name of your last book?
Very straightforward.
The last book was slightly more partisan. It was a compilation of blog posts from my blog, and it had a name. It was called the Tea Publican Book of Lies.
Right. By the way, you'll be happy to know that the blog for Arizona has certainly picked up. I credit you with the term Tea Publican, because we were trying on this show with via Gary to connect the Tea Party and the Republicans.
They are one and the same, but
for a while there was a little denial going on that they were connected.
They're selling the book in the UK. There's a UK guy who's already selling it.
Oh, yeah.
There's another person who wants $34.95 for your book, Gary.
Yeah, Gary got
then,
a bigger piece
then,
of that.
And we then said. He wants $4.95 shipping. I mean,
if only I could get a portion of that. My portion is quite small.
Well, quite frankly, though, if I was in the UK, this title, what they think of American politics, this title people would pay $34 for.
It's for sale in UK bookstores. I mean, it's not, we're kidding around, but yeah, they picked it up. And, it's gotten very good reviews, on Amazon.
I haven't even checked.
You should check. You're getting 4 or 5 stars.
Well, I can tell you at least in part why he's getting those good reviews. First of all, it is a little daunting, and the chapters, it's lies about government, lies about.
Well, why don't you read some of the?
I will be happy
chapter
to.
Titles.
It's a little. The nice part is it can be used as a reference, like I like to use almost all books. Lies about African Americans, lies about the Constitution, lies about crime in courts, lies about Democrats and liberals, lies about the economy, lies about the environment, lies about education, lies about government, lies about guns, lies about healthcare, lies about immigrants, lies about the media, military, poverty, religion, lies about Republicans, lies about terrorism, lies about voting, lies about war.
What are the lies
about Obama? There should be, look, you do a whole book on lies about Obama. But
let's go to lies about economy. We have to pick from this. So what are the lies about the economy? Let me find the right page.
One of my one of my favorites, and it's actually one of the things that got me going on this, is that we're told, you know, by the media, first of all, my philosophy has always been to look at things with great skepticism, as if I just came to this planet from Mars. Does it make, you know, any sense? And if it doesn't on the surface make sense to me, then I'm going to research it, and I'm going to look at a, you know, diversity of sources to see what I can find.
For those listening, Gary does not look like he came from Mars. Gary looks like Charles de Gaulle, for people old enough to remember who Charles de Gaulle
I've heard
is.
That before.
You're about the same height as de Gaulle, and
some French heritage too.
Yeah, so if you're wondering what Gary looks like, just think Charles de Gaulle without the hat, right?
I should get one of those. What kind of got me going on this was a lie that is told repeatedly and so often that it's been accepted as true. And I think you can all confirm that you've heard that the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the world. And so we constantly, you know, the media repeats that, you know, all of the Republican candidates repeat that, and it's accepted. And so I looked it up, and, you know, 'cause I used to own businesses and I used to work for large corporations, and it didn't seem that oppressive to me. And I looked it up, and our tax rate is in fact 35%, the highest tax rate for corporations. But that, you know, is even at that, that's the rate. But even at that, it's only puts us tied for fourth for tax rate, which admittedly is quite high. But when you look at it in a different way, because there's so many, you know, very few corporations pay that, almost none. If you look at it in a different way, which is the only way to compare countries for taxes, is the tax, overall tax burden for corporations as a percentage of GOP.
The effective tax rate.
In other words,
there's the theoretical level that they're paying taxes, and then there's the actual level that corporations are paying taxes in different countries. And there's a huge difference, right, Gary?
Yes.
I mean, percentage points different.
You have huge corporations like General Electric that go years without paying a dime in taxes.
So they actually make money from the tax system.
They get it back, yeah. They get subsidies as well. But when you compare countries, and the only way that you really can, which is a tax burden of corporate tax burden as a percentage of GOP, the U.S. is one of the lowest of the developed nations, and it's actually ranks 64th. It's tied for 64th with Tanzania. So it's just this lie just keeps being, you know, repeated and repeated and repeated.
But our taxes are higher than Somalia?
I would have to look up Somalia. I don't have that at my fingertips. But, so it's things like that that kind of got me going, and so I started looking into, you know, virtually everything I heard coming out of candidates' mouths and researching it. And I get all these emails, you know, chain emails, and I get all these memes that are passed around on Facebook, and I've been guilty of passing on a couple that I didn't research and found out that they were false. So I tried being fair and looked up both Republican and Democratic, and it kept leaning so heavily to the right.
Why would you try to be fair? They're not. This is a partisan show, and I appreciate that. But we're talking about Gary's book. We're talking about Tax-Free Politics by Gary LeMaster, with a long, long, long subtitle. But the other side doesn't try to be fair at all, ever. So whenever I hear both sides are the same, I want to jump in. I want to gouge out the speaker's eyes. Because both sides aren't the same. In your introduction, you talk about the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, who's certainly one of my favorite. There is nothing on the left. Still, I've been saying this on this show for 4 years. There's nothing on the left to answer the American Legislative Exchange Council, that entity which writes the laws in 50 state legislatures, conservative wacko laws, like we see in Arizona, by the way. Arizona is a petri dish. By that I mean a test for the Alec
absurd
philosophy.
And terrible
right.
state laws.
As if Sarah Palin mated with Donald Trump, we got. That's what we have in the Arizona legislature.
It's called model legislation that Alec puts forward. For those who aren't familiar with Alec, it's paid for by large corporations, and it's almost exclusively conservatives that participate in it. And it's conservatives from legislatures all across the country. So the corporations write model legislation that, gee, what a shock, it benefits them. And they put these bills forward as model legislation. They hand them out, 100 and some, a meeting. And the legislators take those back to their own states and put their names on them to sponsor them, often without even reading them.
Well, that's it. And so even if you didn't have a problem with corporations writing your laws, maybe that's not a problem for you. And as Gary said, they write it to benefit them. But it also, in many cases, hurts the rest of us. In other words, whenever the playing field isn't level, especially in America, we kind of think, then it hurts all of us. And that's what happens. And like you said, they'll put their own name on the legislation.
We had a legislature who forgot to take Alec's name off of the bill.
Right.
They
should
put into the legislature. So there it was.
Extremely successful, especially in these anti-government times, because legislative staffs at the state level and the federal level, but especially the state level, have been cut so drastically. There's nobody to the making laws is work. You have to research, you have to put things together, you have to write, and legislative staffs have been cut to the bone.
Well, that actually kind of points up one of the issues that we just experienced with the primary in Maricopa County, where they had the long lines, people waiting in line 5 hours and more to vote in just a primary. They had cut the voting places by two-thirds.
Wow. $4.5 million they cut from the fund.
And it came out of the reason for it, as you research it, the reason that it happened was that the state legislature dramatically cut the funding for elections. And so,
despite protests from every election official, Republican, right, Democrat, Independent, whatever, they all warned them not to do it.
And Helen,
it anyway.
Helen Purcell, who was in charge of it from Maricopa,
since 1988,
made the cuts with the blessing of the Secretary of State, who's supposed to be in charge of elections, Michelle Reagan. And they did it to save money because the state wasn't going to help them fund the elections any longer.
Of all the things we think voting is, no matter what side you're on, by the way, this is bipartisan. We think voting is sacred. We think that we got the best system and we have the worst. We have almost the worst. Short of, people standing around with machine guns and telling you which ballot to vote for. It is a terrible, terrible system. We know the comparison. 4.5 million people live in Maricopa County. 60 voting places. 211,000 people live in Yavapai County. 29 voting places. You do the math, guys. They had some voting places in 750, by the way, per poll is ideal. They had people with 20,000 people that with one polling place. You can't do that. That's where your lines come from.
And as always, the people that paid the heaviest price were the poor and the minorities. They had more percentage wise more voting places in places like Scottsdale and the wealthier communities, because they're going to get a lot of pushback.
Well, Phoenix is Democratic, and it isn't an accident that they that's where the cuts in the polling places were most extensive. It's amazing that everyone could tell them not to do it, and they did it, and it was a disaster. And now there's calls for the Justice Department to investigate.
Well, please don't forget, up until 2013, 9 Arizona counties couldn't make an election decision like they made, by the way, without oversight from the Department of Justice because of our voting violations against the Voting Rights Act. That got gutted by the Supreme Court recently. Yavapai County was one of those counties that couldn't make a vote, couldn't change a polling place, couldn't do anything without having it reviewed by the Department of Justice because we had such a terrible record, because 9 counties in Arizona had such a terrible record with voting rights. Arizona has been in front of voter suppression for a long time now.
Well, this is one of the things I mentioned in the introduction, and it's actually one of the reasons I chose to write this particular book, is that I looked at after the Great Depression, which was caused by Republican policies, the Taft administration and the Hoover administration and so on, you had a Democratic majority in Congress and in the White House for generations. Because the Republicans were paying as a backlash to their policies. And what kind of got me curious with this is we had a recession that was a near depression and according to many economists was worse than the 1929 crash. And within, we as a result had an election that was won by Democrats, so we had a Democratic Congress and we had a Democratic president for 2 years.
Two golden years that they squandered.
And so I started looking at why the difference. I mean, how could they rebound so quickly? And I started realizing and identifying the structural advantages that Republicans have over Democrats. And they are many, and it's been a very conscious plan over a long period of time, where they own the media.
And people believe their positions. And one of the ones you mentioned under economy is they believe in trickle-down economics. People begin to not, to be skeptical of the word, but they still believe in the idea of job creators, trickle-down economics. The Republican Party platform is still cutting taxes on the rich is going to solve all the problems. What do you think?
They own the structure, and they own the vocabulary. Tell us more about owning the structure.
To finish on trickle-down, it's been disproven. It's never been proven to work. It's been roundly disproven by virtually every economist, including the two people that put it in place, or actually reinstituted it, during the Reagan administration. His two advisors, John Stockman and Bruce Barton, have since come out and said, it doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. We can prove it doesn't work.
Then why is it still in the Republican platform?
Because
if it doesn't work, why didn't it die?
Because it benefits the wealthy and corporations. That's why it benefits. I want to talk about, Mike asked about the other structural problems. We've been told since the Nixon administration that the media is liberal. And it's no longer true. It never was true, but it may have leaned somewhat to the left back prior to the Nixon days. But it's been an attack, a relentless attack on the media ever since. And once the Fairness Doctrine was done away with, which required the broadcast media to operate in the public interest, the media swung heavily, heavily to the right. So they have a big advantage with media. They have a structural advantage with money, because large corporations, which are now considered people, can contribute virtually as much as they want to campaigns. They have the organizational structure that we talked about, for example, with ALEC. They, in the red states where the Republicans control the governorship and the legislature, they have been busily gerrymandering districts, congressional districts, so that it virtually has become impossible for a Democrat to ever be elected in those states again. They've been, or at least they're terribly marginalized. They have been working with voter suppression, voter ID laws that, I mean, there have been an infinitesimal number of incidents of in-person voter ID in across the country and billions of votes that they've looked into. And I think out of 2 billion votes, they found something like 11 possible voter ID fraud
right.
cases, and most of those were disproven.
It may be 19, but I think, Gary, isn't it like 16 states have introduced basically voter suppression law? I think we're the only country in the world that tells everybody to vote, and then we make it really, really hard. It's on a Tuesday. It's on a working day, and people don't have the day off.
And in a lot of the minority areas, like in Ohio, there were rampant incidents in black areas where they reduced the number of polls. So they faced the same thing that Maricopa County did, but they do that on a regular basis. So they have a structural advantage with that. There's frankly a willingness to lie and cheat. If you watch Fox News, and look at the fact-checking organizations that fact-check Fox News. I'm talking about Fox News Channel, the cable channel. It's something like 40% of the time, 40% of the things the fact or the statements checked have been proven to be lies.
Yeah.
So,
but they have a massive viewership, Jerry.
Right. This is the largest viewership of cable news.
Well, they feel like people, that's a whole other topic, but people feel like, they're getting the inside scoop, you know, because they're saying, the liberals lies and the government lies and just this whole attitude, this whole entertainment attitude that we're telling you the truth.
But that's a great word because news. I'm a journalism graduate, and I worked as a journalist for periods of time, and I worked in a CBS affiliate station. One of the reasons I got into journalism to begin with was because of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite and CBS News. That was as good a news as you could ever find in the history of the planet. And the media now, ever since they undid the Fairness Doctrine, that unleashed the ability to judge for networks to judge their news organizations based on what the ratings were. And so it's devolved into essentially infotainment. It's information, but it's not really news, and it's certainly not the news that would be useful for voters. And if you look at the local news channels, it's a steady diet of, and Arizona isn't unique in this, but it's a steady diet of fear-based crime and fluff stories to compensate.
We're talking about Gary LeMaster's book this morning, Antidote to Fact-Free Politics. We want you to go out and buy it for yourself. Buy one for your friends, buy one for your relatives.
I feel like Donald Trump. I'm getting all this free publicity.
Well, we're trying our best, Gary.
Don't feel like Donald.
Excellent book. It is well written. It is easy to read, and it is very systematic. Gary has an approach which is systematic for example on lies and economy. How three or four lies that you picked out. How many lies in this book? In economy, it's lie 138.
30.
What
there's,
is it by the end?
There's 159 lies. I was trying to make it you know, an even number, and I had to start cutting. At one point I had something like 200, you know, plus lies, plus I had a complete dictionary to help people understand the jargon of the Republican Party.
What was the most complex lie, Gary, that you think you found? What is the one that people believe the most that is wrong, in your opinion?
Well, so many of them are. I would pick out, one of them would be immigrants steal our jobs. One thing you learn over a period of time, if you pay attention, is that every issue is not black and white. It's many, many shades of gray. And it's very, almost all of them are complex. And you have to dig into the why, rather than just take the soundbite. So when people like Joe Arpaio, and McCain and others talk about, immigrants from Mexico, Trump, calls them all rapists and murderers. When you look into the cause of the, mass migration from Mexico that occurred in the 90s, that was a result of NAFTA and CAFTA. When those bills passed, any trade agreements passed, it had an unintended consequence in that the economies, the agricultural economies of Mexico and Central America are driven by corn. And we subsidize our corporate farmers in the U.S. to the tune of billions of dollars a year. And they are very, very successful in raising corn. And so after that passed, it allowed companies like Cargill and ADM and Continental Grain to dump corn into Central America and Mexico. That had the impact of putting the small farmers in Mexico and in Central America out of business. They could no longer afford to farm. They're small, dirt scratch farms. And it drove them into the cities looking for jobs in order to feed their kids. And they couldn't find jobs in the cities. And so, if you were out of work for a prolonged period of time, you had no welfare system, and your kids were going to starve, what would you do? Would you stay around and watch them starve, or would you do whatever it took to find work? So those people migrated to the U.S. looking for jobs.
So they were welcomed with open arms during the
by the corporations. Yes,
exactly. By everybody.
And so they do jobs that most people, except for the construction industry, and even in that industry, there's many cases of traditional Americans Native Americans won't take the jobs. So, but mostly, it's things like maid services at hotels and picking, vegetables and fruits and farms. That part of our economy hasn't changed, by the way, since I first decided to become a journalist based on a documentary that Edward R. Murrow did, which was called Harvest of Shame, which was chronicling what was happening to migrant workers. That it was a horror show back then. That hasn't changed. But now instead of hiding it, we're using migrant workers that have immigrated or afraid to come out of the shadows.
But aren't migrant workers responsible for the collapse of so much of American industry?
No.
I thought you might say that because I can't see a connection. Although there are certain candidates out there who seem to blame them for basically everything that's happened in the United States they don't like.
In 1979, I was working in an ad agency, and one of my clients was 3M, and I had several other large Fortune 500 corporations as clients. And in 79 was the first time I heard the word globalization. And it was, you know, in our strategy meetings, that, you know, this was, came up over and over, and I kept, you know, looking at my clients, the marketing people from 3M, and saying, globalization, you're already, they were already in every country in the planet selling, you know, 3M products. And so I said, what are you talking about? Well, we have to prepare for global competition. And at the same time, so that was one impact. That was one of the things that caused the meltdown.
Yeah, there's a lot of different impacts.
And the other.
Both trade agreements and globalization generally. The depth of globalization is something people have to understand. The world has really gotten smaller. It's easier to get product from one country to the other. It's in some ways, that's inevitable. I think the problem, Gary, don't you think, is that the way that globalization has been managed has not benefited a lot of ordinary Americans.
Well, the primary reason I would point to is that at the same time I started hearing about globalization, I heard the executives of 3M and other companies start talking about a new structure for executive compensation. And so what they did in the 70s and in early 80s is they based executive compensation on stock prices, on share prices for the company. So if the CEO could drive up the share price, regardless of whether that meant the company was making money or what the impact was to its workers and to the corporation and the brands, if they could drive up the share price, then they profited like never before. And I think that's probably the biggest, you know, cause of the offshoring of jobs.
Slide 29, going back to the book here.
Which book is that, Mike?
That would be Factory Politics by Gary Lemaster. Slide 29 through 51 is about the economy. And one of the, a couple of them, I really want you to talk about the taxation is tyranny. That's an interesting one.
It's you hear that from Republicans a lot that we have this big anti-government movement, and particularly the western and southern states, Arizona being a prime example, and when you look into it, you find that if you take the biggest...
Nobody likes taxes.
Yeah. But if you look at the biggest complainers, Arizona being one of the foremost, it gets back about, I think a dollar, I don't have the book in front of me, but about a dollar and a half, for every from the federal government for every dollar that Arizona puts into the federal economy. So it's an overall taker. States like, you know, where I came from, Minnesota, I haven't looked at it recently, but at one point within the last few years, we were a high tax state, and we were putting in $9 into the federal government for every $1 we got back. So it's kind of, you get what you pay for, number one. If you the whole premise of government, unlike business, is business's goal is to make money. The government's goal, and you hear, you know, Republicans say all the time, government should be run like a business. No, it shouldn't.
Labor unions are killing American business.
Absolutely not true. We have a 2-day weekends, 5-day work weeks, 40-hour work weeks as a result of labor unions. No other reasons.
So we have this legacy to thank labor unions for during the 30s and 40s and 50s, but
There have been periods of corruption with labor unions, like there are periods of corruption with any organization. It's not inherent with labor unions. It's not inherent with any one thing. It's a matter of people.
I ask, who's looking out for the worker? The corporation? Not usually. Although with the threat of unions, sometimes, very often actually, that will improve, that will make the corporation do more, or look, quote unquote, look out for the employee.
If you look at some of the more successful European nations like Germany, they automatically put a labor representative on the board of directors.
Half the board has to be labor representative, people who work in the
factory. And there's nothing like that.
And including the people who are affected by the decisions in the decision-making. What kind of communist are you?
That is really, really terribly communistic.
How about this? How about minimum wage raises as a job killer?
Yeah,
there is no evidence to prove that that's true, and there's abundant evidence to prove that minimum wage actually improves the economy, raising the minimum.
That's why this book is so important. These lies, some of them, I mean, it's got, like I said, 159 lies in 20 chapters.
They're really core
to American belief system here. God, guns, and the lies in Gary's book. What did California do yesterday, by the way, to help you?
They raised the minimum wage.
To what?
$15.
Seattle was one of the leaders in raising minimum wage, and they found that
that's illegal in Arizona, by the way.
They actually boosted their economy. Yeah.
That's Governor Ducey and the state legislators are trying to make that illegal in Arizona.
It is interesting that the legislature complains constantly about the federal government telling them what to do, like they can't discriminate and they can't do this and that. And then they pass all these laws telling the cities what they can't do. They can't have any laws regarding plastic bags. They can't do this, that. There's a bunch of new laws coming down in North Carolina, they passed a law basically keeping the cities from doing any legislation or any rule that protect not only gay and lesbian folks, but pretty much anybody from discrimination.
But they eliminated the rules, folks.
There's an
organization called the Arizona Advocacy Network, tracks Arizona legislation, the House bills and the Senate bills. Check them out. Follow them. I understand that, you may have to up your heart medication, but because it's going to make you angry. What's going on at the legislature right now is going to make you angry.
It really is fascinating that Arizona is one of the biggest complainers about the federal government and biggest believers in state rights. And if you look into that, I have a chapter about a lie about states' rights. But if you look into it, the states' rights that the Republicans like to talk about is really based on the Articles of Confederation, which was the original agreement between the 13 colonies and 13 that became states. And if you look into why we passed the Constitution, created the Constitution and passed it, it was to get around it was to create a strong central government. And to end the problems that were created by these independent states. And so people that want to claim that the states have all these rights and the government has no business telling them what to do are really ignorant about the Constitution and why we have a Constitution.
Exactly. And getting back to the book.
You have a chapter the Constitution.
We have a chapter on lies about the Constitution, which is a
very good chapter.
It could have been five times as long.
Oh, yeah.
Because you talk about the document that the fewest people have read. Or understand.
I like to say people walk around, there's a certain group of people who walk around with the Constitution in one hand and the Bible in the other, and they've read neither.
Exactly.
Or even when they've read them, they haven't understood it.
No.
I think the literalist interpretation of the Constitution is the lowest and least effective and interesting interpretation.
If you really want to understand the the whole issue of states' rights, for example, look into the Federalist Papers and Federalist 10 by James Madison, who, by the way, wrote the Bill of Rights and was really kind of the father of the Constitution. It really talks about the need for a strong central federal government and the weaknesses of strong state governments. And one of the things that he was most fearful of was tyranny by the majority. And he pointed out that becomes a greater issue the smaller the organization or the pool is. So if you have a majority rule for a large country, it's most people can deal with that without feeling like they've been oppressed. But when you get to say a city or smaller groups, then the majority can easily oppress and create a tyranny over the dissenters.
Well, there's a lot of things in the Constitution for exactly that. The tyranny of the majority was a big fear of the founding fathers, and especially
because of the historical.
Getting back to the book, what is it called again? Oh yeah, Antidote for Fact-Free Politics by Gary Lemaster, available on Kindle and many other forms. 20 chapters, but we want to talk about the way the book is told, the style, where each of the lies, or almost all of them, anyway, are explained, and you have the history. So you have a little narrative there. You have a little story here. So that's what makes it more readable. We've already talked about how useful it is as far as being able to look at the chapters, the things that you know. There's the 20 chapters, lies about this, lies about that. And
by the way, this isn't my opinion. Like I said, I have about 45 pages of references, and for the references, I primarily used government sources, nonpartisan sources like the Congressional, the CBO, Congressional Budget Office. One of the lies I really want to get to, if I may, is political correctness. This is a biggie with the Trump campaign.
Yeah.
Deriding political correctness, and all of these people cheering whenever he brings up, how evil political correctness is. Well, when you think about it and you look into it, what is political correctness?
Manners.
It's politeness. It's
we don't want any of that.
It's not demeaning someone who is different.
That's weak.
It's being careful to use language that isn't diminishing others and to try to be polite to them. And so when you decry political correctness, yeah, it can get out of hand to a point, but when you decry political correctness, you're really trying to tell people it's okay to call people names and to demean them and to ridicule them. It's one of the meanest things I think about this election.
But that's
cycle.
What some people want to do. They want to be able to call people names, don't they? They never really, they feel a real constriction when they can't call people names.
Yeah, they want to, if you think about over our lifetimes, how much progress we've made in getting rid of things that, sayings that put down minorities and people who have infirmities and
or women
or other religions
or people with glasses. I mean, we can go on and on.
Or other races. They're legion. I mean, we've gotten rid of most of that, and thanks to Donald Trump, we're bringing
it all
back.
Yeah, that's making America great again.
Oh, what do we have 1 minute, Gary. Any last thoughts on the book? We can repeat the name of it one last time. Antidote for Fact-Free Politics. And that's really what it is. It's a whole selection of what would you say, criticism of ideas that are just
This is a great book
true.
To give your uncle, to give that conservative uncle. Just give him the book. Buy him the book. Give him the book for his birthday or for Easter or for Groundhog Day or
it's
something.
It's kind of heavy. We got to say
thank you to Democrats at Red Rocks for their continued and wonderful support. We have to talk about our next show, and which is going to be something really good.
Heidi, we're going to be talking about compassion in politics.
Compassion in politics. That figures. A bunch of Democrats sitting around talking about compassion. I don't know. I might not even tune in next week. Okay, guys, thank you. Don't forget, you can find this show, all our shows, on vvd.org. vvd.org.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.